This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
Well, it's great to have as our guest this morning, Tom Engelhardt. Tom created and runs the TomDispatch.com website. He's a contributor to LouRockwell.com. Take a look at his archive. He's author of a number of books, The End of Victory Culture, which is a revisionist history of American triumphalism during the Cold War, which seems, Tom, by the way, to continue despite the end of the Cold War.
Yes, it never ends, does it?
And Tom's written a novel. He teaches at journalism school at Berkeley every spring. But when I think about you, I think of you as an old-fashioned journalist, someone who wants to tell the truth, wants to explain to people what's actually happening and who's doing what to whom. And maybe I can sum it up by saying you're not a tool of the power elite, which definitely separates you from the commanding heights of American journalism. And I've been so impressed by the work you've done, not only your own writing, but the writers that you've introduced LouRockwell.com readers to. These last years of the Bush regime, the police state, all the wars, all the lying, all the propaganda, the spying. What made you a champion of privacy and natural rights and peace? What led you into all this?
You know, I think, honestly speaking, I think it's just, and it comes from somewhere deep in my past, I think it's a combination of a deep dislike of empires. I'm just anti-imperial at heart. I think one at a time I would have thought of myself differently politically, but I think that's the heart of what I am. I don't like empires. I don't like seeing us abroad doing the things that we're doing. And, you know, and I also have, again, you know, this is something I think that's a little more alien to young people today, but I, growing up in the 50s, I have some kind of a sense of civic duty still with me. I think once upon a time that would have been expressed, although the Vietnam War stopped that from actually working within the government, but I always had this feeling of some civic duty. Now I feel my civic duty is being a critic and at TomDispatch.com. It seems to me like a civic duty. I do other things mostly for my living, but I just, it's just a mobilized moment for me. You know, I want to say one thing. You said I was a journalist. These days when people ask me if I'm a journalist, I actually deny it. I say that professionally speaking, I'm a guy in a room. And that sounds very modest, I suppose. But I actually think that the advantage that I have, you have, and other people like us have over journalists. I mean, I'm an admirer of many journalists. I think they do great work. They go out, they explore, and so on and so forth. But the advantage a guy in a room has is I never have lunch with an admiral. I never talk to congressional aides. I'm never caught in what is kind of the Stockholm syndrome of Washington. So I feel like I often can see the very evident forest, and I'm not lost in the trees. And I think that's the greatest advantage I have. And you too, and other people like us. I don't think it's special to me. You publish Glenn Greenwald all the time. I think he's the same. You know, you can just sit here, and in some ways you can see a world that if you are a journalist in that Washington world particularly, you can't make these connections. You just can't see them. Why? It's an interesting question.
Well, there's no question the whole, whether it's official journalism or the think tank culture, or the as you say, the congressional aides, all the people who are on the state payroll, either directly or indirectly, they all know, they actually don't have to be told what views to adopt, what positions to take in order to advance themselves.
That's right.
And they know very well what not to say, but what positions not to take that might hurt them. So they're just careerists.
It's kind of in the blood. It's not very conscious. Actually, the thing that strikes me, having taught, you know, I kind of would parachute into this journalism school. I actually don't do that anymore, but I did up till this year in the spring, and I'd be an editor to a group of young potential journalists. But what always struck me when journalists came through is I used to say that my father-in-law he's not alive anymore, was a CPA, so no offense to CPAs, but I used to say if you put three CPAs and three top journalists up on stage, the CPAs would be the introspective ones. Journalists are not, they don't understand the world that they're in. It's a fascinating thing. I mean, they really are, they operate in it, they can be very interesting about how they do things, but they grasp the world they're in only in the most conventional ways.
Was it Chomsky who said that America, like Athens, was unusual in world history to have a massive empire and yet deny it?
Yes. I don't know if it was him, but it certainly is true. And you know, I mean, for instance, in one of the things I was struck by it again the other day, I mean, the U.S. Air Force wiped out a wedding party in Afghanistan the other day. Now, This has been going on since the first wedding party was wiped out in Afghanistan in 2001. I've been following this. It doesn't seem complicated to me. Each of these is reported. Actual reporters report these. And yet, you never see this described as a real pattern. I mean, I've actually, at Tom Dispatch, been adding up. And I add up six, at this point, six between Iraq and Afghanistan, but mainly Afghanistan, six confirmed wedding parties wiped out from the air by the U.S. Air Force in these last years. And that is some kind of a record. I mean, that's bizarre, and it should, and to me, it's actually shocking. And I would think that that would be a constant story, and yet I write about it. I mean, you put these at your website, antiwar.com would use a piece like that at their website, but generally speaking, even though each of these incidents is reported, and sometimes they remember the last one, the actual pattern isn't reported, and the pattern's the important thing in this case. Air power has long been basically the American way of war. In this case, the war that the U.S. Air Force is fighting is not a war against terror. It's a war that creates terror. You bomb someone's village, you bomb an Afghan village, and you've created a village full of whoever's left of enemies. I mean, this is like, it's a kind of curious madness, and its parts are reported, but the whole is very seldom seen.
As a libertarian, I'd say part of that has to do with the fact that the state sees itself as above the law, and it teaches us that it's above the law, and so that the things that we would do in private society that would rightly be seen as crimes, when it does it, they're not crimes, just policy. I remember at the beginning of Bush's horrible war in Iraq, the second U.S. war in Iraq, when he'd gotten some of that fabled U.S. intelligence that Saddam Hussein and his sons were eating at a restaurant. So he dropped a, you know, whatever it was, a 1,000, 5,000-pound bomb, whatever, on this restaurant.
Yeah.
Turned out they weren't there. Killed a whole bunch of waiters and customers and busboys and the chef and so forth. Why isn't this an act of murder? I mean, he committed murder. This is an act of murder, but because he's a state official, because it's the government Air Force doing it, why, it's just, you know, that's just everyday affairs, and don't be concerned about it. In fact, so this is the one of the ways that official journalism works with the state to suppress any concerns about these sorts of things and make us think that the government can do no wrong. It might make mistakes. It might make mistakes out of the goodness of its heart. It gets caught in a quagmire in Vietnam, but there's never an indication that the U.S. government might actually set out to do something wrong and do something wrong, and yet I would argue that's its daily bread and its daily activities.
Yes, and one of the things is that the press, again, I think this is this kind of Stockholm syndrome, the press takes on the language, even without thinking about it, the language of both of the government and, in this case, of the Pentagon. I mean, the classic example of this is the use, which is constant, of collateral damage, which is that these civilians are called, civilian deaths are called collateral damage in our world. Now, if you really look at the number of deaths in Iraq, as best we can grasp them in Iraq and in Afghanistan as well, and this is true in almost all modern wars, as far as I can see, and it's something that Howard Zinn, who was a bomber in World War II, has written about quite movingly. Civilian deaths often make up, I don't have the figures in front of me, but it could be 70-80% of deaths. I mean, once upon a time when armies fought, not in every war, but certainly in many wars, the armies kind of fought each other. I mean, civilians always obviously died. But in our wars, more and more civilians are dying, so that thing that we call collateral damage, that is, collateral being on the side, is in fact the most central part of modern war. It's not collateral at all. You might say that the death of soldiers is now collateral damage in our typical wars. And I mean, just in terms of numbers. And of course, if you're fighting a war in which, you know, you assumedly want to bring people over to your side, you can't, you know, there's an essential contradiction. Forget what you think about why we're there or anything else. In the very mission as it's described of the U.S. and these countries, because of course you can't simply slaughter people and hope that they're going to support you. This is like a kind of a long-term hopeless situation. You can, of course, wipe them out. We do have the power to do that. I do agree. I on the crimes of government, I mean, the one thing I would say is that we have seen a particular level in these last years of not just crime, but pride in crime. I mean, of course, they didn't literally think of it as crime, but, you know, this government, the Bush administration, the Bush government, has been more, in a way, open about its crimes, ready to brag more about its crimes than any in our memory, I think. I mean, you would never, if you go back to Vietnam, where many of the same things obviously went on, you would not have found Vice President Humphrey openly lobbying Congress for torture. The president had a kind of deniability, and, you know, this happened at a lower level. It happened. It was widespread. But it is striking that in these years, this was an these crimes were openly discussed. It's been a particularly criminal enterprise these last 8 years, I would say.
Does this have anything to do with the arrogance of the neocons? I mean, the neocons have had important influence in past administrations, but with Bush, it seemed to be almost an entirely a neoconservative administration, Cheney, among others. These are very arrogant people. Even by D.C. standards, they're arrogant. So is that, do you think that's part of it?
Well, you know, I've long argued, I mean, it's often said that the Bush administration was, particularly in its first term and a little beyond, a fundamentalist administration. And usually what's meant is Christian fundamentalism. And then when you really look at the administration, I mean, there were some Christian fundamentalists in it, but in fact, you know, it wasn't particularly a Christian fundamentalist administration. But I've always argued it was, in fact, a fundamentalist administration. And this goes back to your point about the neocons in a very different sense. And that was that this group of people, the president, Cheney, and the neocons in particular, who were peppered through the government in those years, they came into office with a kind of a blind, romantic assessment of American military power. They were wowed by it. Almost none of them had actually been in the military. They weren't military men, mostly they were men, but they were wowed by military power, and they really thought, I mean, this is where I think it was a kind of a blind faith. They believed that they could do away with past international relations. That you really had that they were at a moment where they had a kind of a power that no one before had had, and they were thinking about a kind of global domination using military power of a sort that, I've written this, that in my childhood you would have only heard, you know, Imperial Japanese, Soviet, or Nazi, whatever, villains in movies. This was the sort of thing that the villains said in the movies I grew up with. But it was a kind of, in their deep fundamentalist faith in military power above all, in shock and awe, they really misunderstood the nature of power in our world. So it was like a blind, romantic, fundamentalist faith, and it was a kind of hubris, and it was a disaster from their point of view, and of course it was a disaster from the world's point of view as well.
Tom, any coincidence that these believers in the bomb overseas are also believers in the nightstick here at home?
No, I think the striking thing about our period, I mean, this is what strikes me about so-called conservatism, and I don't mean conservatism, I mean so-called the conservatism, the governmental conservatism of recent years, is that it has had almost totally to do, you know, while there's been a kind of a starving off of what were old government services, or a kind of a functional ineptitude to that, and a privatizing out of those things, what there was a strengthening at every level, at home and abroad, of the state power. You know, I mean, that is the nightstick and the bomb. I mean, that was what they were focused on. And, of course, they were focused similarly at the governmental level on the strengthening of presidential power, you know, the creation of a commander-in-chief presidency. I mean, they called it the unitary executive theory or whatever. But it basically was, from top to bottom, an attempt to strengthen state power. And the sad thing is we are going to be left now. Bush will leave, you know. I mean, in terms of what they thought they were going to do, they imagined a Pax Americana abroad and a kind of a Pax Republicana, but, I mean, their version of the Republican Party at home. And both of those are in utter disarray. They leave with catastrophe on those two levels. But, of course, they leave us behind a legacy, and it is that legacy of state power. We will never again have a moment in our lives, I am convinced, when we won't have a so-called Homeland Security Department. I mean, that's one of the worst words. You know, one of the things the Bush people did is they also put words in our language, which really are awful. I mean, homeland, holy Toledo. Didn't we used to call it country? or something like that. Homeland, it's like right out of, you know, the Soviet fatherland or the Nazi Heimat. I mean, we have one defense department, which is obviously not meant for defense, and then we have the second thing, which is a defense department called the Homeland Security Department, which is a giant, inept, but very potentially oppressive thing, and I don't think it's ever going to go away. We have 18, more than 18, we have officially 18 intelligence agencies, departments, offices, whatever. If you look at the U.S. intelligence community, as it likes to call itself, you can go to Google and just Google it up, and you'll see the list of them. You know, there are 18 intelligence, and this doesn't count all of them. There are all sorts of little intelligence operations that aren't on that list. You know, I mean, what kind of a country, what kind of a labyrinth of power is this? I mean, it can't possibly produce intelligence. I mean, it can't produce intelligence, but it can produce control of various sorts and a giant bureaucratic whatever. Yeah.
In the old days of the PRI in Mexico, we used to look down on them as having an elected dictatorship.
Right.
But it seems to me we now have an elected dictatorship. And it's, of course, the president is far more powerful in American society and the world than the poor president of Mexico ever thought of being. And yet Americans, you know, would call this freedom. What they define as freedom is military domination overseas and an all-powerful national security state at home.
Well, listen, let me tell you the good news. Just for us, the good news is I spent a little time with a leading Mexican political cartoonist, and we were having lunch. Sometime over lunch, he said to me, you know, Tom, the pre-period, that PRI one-party period, you know, it was a great shame in our country, but for us political cartoonists, we were like pigs in slop. So for us, I mean, the one thing this does is give us a, you know, TomDispatch.com can be there till I drop. We know that the coming years are you know, we're going to be dealing with the versions of the same thing. I mean, we don't have these kind of mad children in power. We have people who are reasonably sane, they're reasonably grown up, but I mean, this is the final year or so of the Bush administration in foreign policy and the coming Obama administration, which is going to have many similarities. But we have people who have similar visions of, you know, guarding, being the guardians or custodians of what functionally is an imperial world. I mean, this is why, you know, I mean, we know that that whatever complicated solutions they're thinking about, that Obama and his people are about, they are determined to have what really is the equivalent of the surge in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, isn't it slightly alarming that Obama picked as his chief of staff and enforcer within his administration Rahm Emanuel, who is a belligerent warmonger and a total neocon and seems to me a very bad guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be a mixed bag, but it's not going to be. I mean, I just wrote a piece about it today. Anybody can go to my site and see it, and a piece called "Don't Let Barack Obama Break Your Heart," because of course all the people who worked for him, as Americans do, are now going to go home and let him assumedly solve their problems, and he won't. I mean, we know we have some sense of what his foreign policy, forgetting domestic policy, is going to look like, and it's going to be different. But you know, I mean, there will be some relief there, but mostly we are. I think we're going to see we've been through this once with Democrats, and that was, you know, there was a Democratic president who was very focused on domestic policy, who inherited a war and chose to escalate it. And that was Lyndon Johnson in 1964. We know what happened. You know, there's a very similar set of forces here. I mean, Obama's actually inheriting a war in three quarters, maybe two and a quarter, because you have the Iraq, the very tenuous situation in Iraq, which could explode at any moment. From which he says he's withdrawing, but it's not quite a withdrawal plan. If you actually look at it, he's talking about only half of U.S. combat forces. You have a war in Afghanistan that will escalate, and then it seems, as far as we can tell, from what he's said so far, and people around him have said, that he's opted into, he's accepted the bogus framework within which all of this operated from the Bush administration, which is the so-called global war on terror, a war that ignores borders, sovereignty, international law, and everything else in relation to, you know, small scattered groups of terrorists. All I say, Lou, is I think we're going to, you know, this is not, right now people don't mostly want to hear this, but we're going to be around for a while.
Tom, it impresses me as imperialism with a human face.
Yes, probably something like that. I mean, I like to be a little more hopeful, but, you know, I am 64 years old.
Well, I'm 64 too, right? So,
well, there we are.
If we could sing, we'd go off with the Beatles.
We're too old for the moment, maybe, but you know, we'll just hang in there, Lou.
Tom Englehart, thanks very much. Take a look at Tom's archive on LouRockwell.com. Take a look at his novel on The Last Days of Publishing. Take a look at his book on the end of victory culture. Tom Englehart, thanks very much.
Thanks, Lou.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show, produced by LouRockwell.com. The best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@lourockwell.com. And thanks for listening.